Three times in the Gospel of Luke, Jesus was a guest in the home of a Pharisee. And we pointed out that each time, in one way or another, he ends up being inspected by his hosts and having judgments made about him by the people who had invited him into their homes. In each of these cases, Jesus ends up being the teacher and not the guest. Remember with the Simon the Pharisee in Luke chapter 7, when the woman comes in and touches him, as Simon says, and the Lord taught him. And then here in Luke chapter 11, starting down at verse 37, there was a Pharisee who invited him home, and I want to kind of remind us of the situation here so we'll be able to see the point. The Pharisees, remember, were people who were intending to make sure that they kept themselves undefiled, and their approach was sort of this. I'm going to say it this way. Do not break the law. And by the law, we mean, of course, the law of Moses. And the way in which they approached this was to have raised up for them a series of traditions about what the rabbis had said about how you keep from breaking the law. In other words, how you keep from getting close to breaking the law. Now, in order to follow that approach, they had to have what's called here in Luke their lawyers, or more often referred to as scribes in the other gospel records, whose job was to explain to them or to be able to cite what had been the tradition of the fathers about how to keep from breaking the law. So you have one kind of works in tandem to the other. This is tradition about how to not break the law. All right. And that, if you'll think of it that way, I think you'll understand how there come to be issues between Jesus and these people. Now, with the Pharisees, to start with, Jesus has taught them that their main point is, their main problem is, that they end up, because of their approach, cleansing the outside, but not inside. Now, what did he mean by that? Because of their approach to right standing with God, why did they end up having this problem?
They looked good on the outside, but inside they were full of greed and contempt.
All right. Because their intention was not to defile themselves, they ended up thinking about outward actions only. And they would end up, or could end up, believing that if they, for example, did not engage in immoral behavior, then it didn't matter if they showed a very harsh or condemning spirit toward people who engaged in immoral behavior. You see, if they did not rob someone, then it didn't matter if they walked by and left the guy who had been beaten and robbed laying there, because they hadn't inflicted the harm themselves. All right, now, with the lawyers, whom we need to talk about a little bit today, what happens is that Jesus ends up saying that their problem will be that they keep the law, but they miss the spirit of it. They miss the intention of the law. this goes hand in hand with that problem, but it is a an issue that causes them to harden their hearts toward the teaching of Jesus about how to apply what God's will would be to real life situations. Now, I'd like for us to notice in our passage here, and we're kind of jumping in toward the end of something we've already spent a good bit of time with. When Jesus spoke to the Pharisees, notice in Luke 11, verse 45, one of them said, "Teacher," one of the lawyers said, "Teacher, in saying these things, you insult us. You've spoken against us also." Now, why? Why did this fellow feel insulted by what Jesus had said in pronouncing woe against the Pharisees? He couldn't help but see that this man could not help but see that he was implicated in the same spirit or the same approach that the Pharisees were. He in fact, had been, these lawyers were enablers to the approach that the Pharisees took. The Pharisees, remember, are not, there were things then that people admired about the Pharisees. We respect their dedication and their intention. It's just that they were on the wrong track. That's the problem. And you can kind of see that. Now, with the lawyers, notice number 8 on your paper. I've asked you to describe the ways of the lawyers over which Jesus pronounced the three woes here. So let's start with verse 46. What is the, how would you describe the woe? That is, notice this is the sadness because of what's going to become of them over their, because of their practices here. What's his first woe about? "Woe to you lawyers also, for you load people with burdens hard to bear, and you yourselves do not touch the burdens with one of your fingers."
Want people to do something they're not willing to do themselves.
All right. If you're going to be a careful student of the law, and you're going to search out all of the things that the fathers have said about the law and how to keep it and what is not to be done and so forth, what at least should go along with that investigation? There should be the intention to try to live by that standard yourself, right? It makes no sense to study either Scripture or what's written about Scripture with all carefulness and depth and thoughtful investigation with no intention to do anything about it. That's always with no intention to make any personal application, and that's the circumstance here. Now, the other side, the other part of it that's the woe that he pronounces, I think, is that they're willing to require this is a what other people have to do approach. They're willing to make demands of other folks that they're not willing to try to meet themselves. Now, it's so easy to fall into that trap, isn't it? This is just a human practice. This doesn't happen to us because we're evil. It happens to us because we're human. One of the things that happens to us is that in order to keep from having to confront our own weaknesses, we will identify and talk about the weaknesses of other folks. And that's the first woe that is being pronounced here. And you notice. All right, look at the second one, verses 47 and 48. This is an interesting one. Tell me what you think it meant. "Woe to you, for you build the tombs of the prophets whom your fathers killed. So you are witnesses, and you consent to the deeds of your fathers, for they killed them, and you build their tombs." In what way is the spirit of the lawyer here like the spirit of the of their fathers?
You build a tomb to memorialize something.
And all right.
And the effort to kill the prophets was not put away or anything like that. They built a tomb to memorialize what their fathers had done by killing the prophets.
They're sort of endorsing the deed in a way. I read somewhere in working on this that the fathers put the prophets in the tombs, and these guys were keeping them there. That's the way you think of the building of the tombs, not to honor the prophets, which they were ostensibly thinking that they were doing, but. Yeah, they were making sure by their approach to the law. Remember, what did the prophets come along? The prophets came along and applied the law and challenged the shortcomings of the people who were breaking the law and ignoring the law. They held people's feet to the fire, and they ended up being killed over it. And now these lawyers, instead of holding people responsible to the law, to the real spirit of the law, justice and mercy and faith and so forth, they're finding it easier to keep up the tombs of the prophets. And therefore to keep the prophets' demands sort of hidden. Okay.
Matthew 23, it talks about, they said, we wouldn't have done this to the prophets.
Yes, yeah, yeah. But they're showing the same spirit. And that's what I mean here when it says they're missing the intention of the law. And, in the Old Testament, I just remind you for a second that the people found it easier to offer the sacrifices and to go through the rituals than they did to do justly and love mercy and to walk humbly with God. And that's sort of the idea here as well. So the first woe is for binding burdens on people you don't intend to touch. The second one is for keeping the prophets that their fathers killed in entombed instead of involved in life. And then the third woe is verse 52. Notice it. Woe to you lawyers, for you have taken away the key of knowledge. You did not enter yourselves, and you hindered those who were entering. Now, what is he talking about there? If I were to supply the phrase "into the kingdom," it might make it applicable. Or I could supply the phrase "into obedience to the law," and it would fit well, I think.
What I see here is the lawyers were holding the old law up in front of the people to hinder them from listening to the gospel of Jesus.
All right. Well, that's, I think, a part of it. I wonder if they were even measuring up to the old law in a way. Brian, what were you going to say?
It seems to me it's kind of an attitude that's still prevalent. It's, what do you know? We're educated. We'll tell you what it says and what to believe and how to interpret it, and you trust us, and you don't worry about it because you don't have this paper, you don't have this certificate.
All right, I think that's a big part of it. You're not informed. You don't have the ability to handle this. Let me give you another possibility with this. As an illustration, remember what we've learned in another setting here about the way they handled the law, for example, honor your father and mother. Jesus dealt with that problem when some of these controversies with the Pharisees came up, and Mark chapter 7 is one of the cases that we've noticed. Now, that was what the law said. Now, do any of you remember some of the machinations that they went through to get around the spirit or the intention of that law. And all they went through, they'd go through all of these. You start with that simple statement: honor your father and mother, and remember how they worked it around. Anybody?
Give it to God.
Instead of taking care of the parents, they're going to give it to
them. All right. They would say that they would say, well, what I have is Corban. It's like a living trust. I've given it to the temple, and I'll use it for my selfish purposes while I'm alive. I can't use it to help care for my father and mother and so forth, because I've given it to God. It's devoted to Him. And therefore, they would be... That's an example of what Jesus is talking about here, I think. Instead of just straight up dealing with the basic principles of what God wanted, they would go through all of these traditions and all of these confusing volumes of regulations that have been attached to it or added to it over the years, and they would keep people from doing the basic thing that the Lord intended for them to do. In the Sermon on the Mount, in Matthew chapter 5, it's mostly this kind of thing, if you go back and read it. What the difference between what the people then had heard it said and what Jesus said. And it's a lot of this type of thing here. Now, I want for us to see that these two tendencies are things that Jesus confronted in people's homes and things that He challenged. He wanted people to see what will happen to you if you focus on keeping outside in order and garbage inside, and what will happen to you if you focus on keeping regulations and you forget the point of it, of what kind of person that you are becoming in the process. Now, I've asked another question on your paper that I don't want us to spend a lot of time with. Why did the Lord's statement about the blood of the prophets being required of that generation have relevance in this setting? And I'll just give you a simple answer to it. It's the kind of thing that Jesus said was going to be judged. This kind of action is bound to meet its downfall, and it will. God does hold people accountable for that kind of thing. And in that generation, it was going to lead up to the fall of the Jewish system. In AD 70, the city was judged by the Roman general, and sort of ended the whole system. So I've asked also, was Jesus rude to have said these things while He was a dinner guest? So what do you think of that?
I don't think so, because I don't think He was really a guest.
All right, I agree with Jan. I think she said it. I don't think so, because He wasn't really a guest. He was invited. Remember, the guy interrupted his teaching, invited him there, and the first thing the guy does is to start to I can't believe He did that. I never saw anything like this before. And Jesus is addressing a need. He's not being rude. He's trying to help them. And that's an important part of this story. Now, I want you to turn with me. Anybody with any further comments over this passage? We talked more about it last week. Ruth?
I think we have time to see if we could still do this today.
Of course.
I think that we can be very legalistic.
With every one of these houses that we've studied Jesus going to, there are some things in them that still are like us today. Why is that? Because they're houses where people live. And in our case, the Lord is calling for authenticity before Him, genuineness or sincerity before Him, and both of these practices are enemies of that. in our houses, if there's anywhere, folks, where you are known for who you really are, it's at home. And that's the point of this. Jesus is dealing with who people really are and not who they are sort of pretending to be or role-playing to be. Now, I want to turn to Luke 14 with you for a second. And this may take us the rest of today and then next week as well. But we go to the house of another Pharisee. And I just want to mention to you the other side of this issue that I think may have relevance to the spirit of our age. I believe that I have noticed in my long lifetime, I used to could say that figuratively and I can't anymore. I've noticed in my long lifetime, when I was coming along, what was happening in our society is that we were reacting to the Pharisaical spirit. And we were reacting to this situation where people approach things by doing things outwardly and it not being matched by inward reality. That was supposed to be something that was for us baby boomers, that was supposed to be our parents' generation that carried on appearances on the outside and tried to live in a cookie-cutter house in a suburb somewhere and go through the motions of dad going off to work and mom raising the kids and being like Ozzie and Harriet or something like that. We were going to be genuine people. Peace, love, and whatever went along with that. Did you know Barney and I are from the hippie generation? we are. Well, that's the idea. I believe that over time, if you watch culture, we were well-known hippies, weren't we, Barney? If you watch culture, the pendulum swings. And I think what's happened to us, this just my evaluation. Now then, I think that we've come to the place where we think that there is no objective. What does objective mean? It means outward, no reality from outside self. Inward is subjective, outward is a standard from outside me, from outside of an individual. So now then we've gotten to the place where we think there are no objective standards. And people now, I walked in the house from shoveling sidewalk the other day and Oprah was on TV and I just happened to time it perfectly and Oprah said, I remember who she was talking to, she said, my definition of spirituality is if you have an open heart. And this is the Oprah generation. We believe that there are no demands outside of self. Now, it's interesting that in the home of this Pharisee, Jesus puts that idea to the test. And I'm going to be asking you to notice that what Jesus says is to say, now, wait a minute. What goes on inside of you not only needs to be real, it needs to be right. That's the part of it that I believe that in my generation we forgot to look at. We decide it just needs to be real, but we define real as whatever I feel, whatever I like, whatever I want to do. Whatever, I mean, you have your reality and I'll have mine and we'll both be
wrong.
That's not the way our generation filled in the blank, but it's often right. Do you guys see what I'm talking about? We may, it's easy to react to Phariseeism in our culture because it's so obviously on the wrong track. But let's not forget that if our reacting to it is to say, all right, nothing matters but what you think inside of you, that can't be right either.
Appearances do count.
All right.
They're not everything, but they
count. They're not everything. If appearances are not matched by intentions, they're empty. But if intentions are not guided by something, then they're dangerous too. I want to take everybody back just to keep your finger here at Luke 14 for a minute. But go back with me to the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5, and then Karen mentioned Matthew 23 a few minutes ago, and I want to point out something from that passage with us too. In Matthew 5, please notice verse 19. Matthew 5, verse 19. Brendan, read that for us, please.
Whoever then knows one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever keeps and teaches them, he shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven.
All right. The word annuls in that version gets translated relaxes or what are the other translations?
Breaks.
Sets aside. Whoever sets aside one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. So Jesus is not trying to teach here to just set the commandments aside. No, that's an important point. Look at Matthew 23 with me for a second. And this has a part of a phrase in it that we've noticed in Luke chapter 11 last week. Matthew 23, verse 23. Randy, read that for us, please.
Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees and hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin, and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness.
All right, that part of it we've heard a good bit. All right, that part of it, we may have a hard time obeying it, but we know it at least. But that's not where the verse ends. Look at it, Randy. Rest of it.
These you ought to have done without neglecting the others.
Was it ridiculous for the scribes and the Pharisees to think that you ought to? And under the law of Moses, they should have tithed even the thing from their garden. All right, they know that Jesus was not recommending that they just forget that. It doesn't matter what he was saying is, it's wrong to be so detailed about this, and then to ignore justice and mercy and faith. But then he says, these you should have done, but you should have done it while not leaving the other undone. All right. You kind of see.
The Pharisees were so struck on themselves, is the way I see it, and they elevated themselves so much that the ordinary person was overlooked.
Yes.
And
or maybe overwhelmed, like Brian said a while ago.
If you didn't do it like they did it, you were wrong.
Yes. And they ended up, we found out last week, they ended up enjoying the attention that they got by their approach to things like that. So that's part of it. All right. Now, a little bit into Luke 14 now. I start here. What are the details about this setting that get your attention, that impress you? And I'd like for us to read three verses to see the point. Luke 14, verse 1. Russ, get this for us. Verse 1, Becky, get verse 7 and 12. There are several details in this short reading that I want for us to notice. Russ.
One Sabbath, when Jesus went to eat in the house of a prominent Pharisee, he was being carefully watched.
Okay, Becky.
And he began speaking a parable to the invited guests when he noticed how they had been picking out the places of honor at the table, saying to them, read 12.
Just the first part of 12, first phrase in 12.
And he also went on to say to the one who had invited
him. All right, stop there for right now. Now, there are several details that we learn about this situation and those unimpressive parts of this passage here. What are the details that are important?
It's a Sabbath.
All right, it's a Sabbath, which means... What about the preparation of the meal?
It had to be done before.
All right, it had to have been done beforehand, or at least the most part of the work. And that means that there had to have been plans made about this situation. This is a planned meal. This is not a y'all come over on the spur of the moment deal. All right. What else do you notice?
They're watching it.
All right, they're watching him. This is not merely a social occasion. What does that tell you about the other guests? There are other people, verse 7 says, who were invited. Huh?
Strategic planning.
There has been a strategic guest list here. You want to bear that in mind as we get into this story. What else? What other detail strikes you?
The Bible says he was a member of the Sanhedrin.
All right. The NIV translates it a prominent Pharisee, ESV, a ruler of the Pharisee. The general consensus is that that means that he was, if not a member of the Sanhedrin, which a lot of the scholars will say is what this means, then at least a very influential and known ruler or leader among the sect of the Pharisees. More likely, I think, a member of the council. All right, and what else? This fellow had invited Jesus to be a guest in his house. That's an important detail. Jesus was there as a guest. And then notice the way that the people, the other guests, sort of clamored for the places of honor. You get the impression that you are among a company of large egos. Don't you get that impression in this reading here? All right, you almost feel like you're amongst a bunch of networkers, and these guys are not there. When they look at you in the eye and say hi, how you doing? What they're thinking is, I want to know how this brother is doing. It's not what I want to know how this brother is doing. It's that this guy might do something for me sometime. I might need him to put in a good word for me somewhere. I hate that kind of stuff, and I think most people do as well. Now, how's this episode similar to the other occasions? Well, they're watching him carefully. How's it different?
It says at the end of the last section that they start to plot against him.
All right.
It's not just...
This may be a part of
listening to what he's saying and then saying, hey, I'm going to find out more.
I think also this is different because in this case, Jesus actually talks to them about their behavior, about their specific behavior, and not about the inward attitudes or the woe. In the other places, he pronounces woe upon them. Now then, he's talking to them about how to go about and do the right thing. And I think that makes it a great passage in that way. Did both bells get me, or are we still waiting for the other ones?
Time for the
time for both. I don't know.
It's time?
I haven't heard either one of them.
Okay. Since we're going to need to talk about this fellow with the dropsy, nobody here has dropsy today, do you? Then we'll save it for next week. If you would please take the outline and read through this long, this is a longer section than the others, and do some thinking about the questions I posed so we can talk about them next week. Everybody have a great week.